I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Lynn Olson joins me now, the best-selling author and historian, has just published a new book, Last Hope Island, Britain, Occupied Europe, and the Brotherhood that Helped Turn the Tide of War. Like her previous books, this one is bound to be a bestseller, and how. It's a riveting read about how England became a crucial center against Hitler as exiled leaders throughout Europe congregated. Charles de Gaulle had come from France, as had Polish pilots and codebreakers, and kings and queens from Norway and Holland. As usual, Miss Olson provides the reader with a remarkable cast of characters, people who deserve their rightful place in history, with narratives colored by their exploits, courage, heroism, and humanity. Lynn Olson is the author of bestsellers Those Angry Days, Citizens of London, Troublesome Young Men, The Murrow Boys, Freedom's Daughters, and A Question of Honor. The website for more is at lynolson.com. This new book is published by Random House. I am very pleased to welcome to the Planta on the Line program from Toronto, Ontario, in early April, Lynn Olson. Ms. Olson, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
So I've read most of your books, and they're just terrific insights into the times that you write about, brought to life by these fascinating characters. Some we know, some we don't. How do you decide to write about these people, this remarkable cast of characters in Last Hope Island?
Well, I had done research. I mean, I've written 7 books, and 6 of those have dealt in some way with England in World War II. And in the course of doing research for these other books, I came across this wonderful story of leaders from occupied Europe fleeing to England, to London, to continue fighting against the Germans. It was a hard decision to winnow it down. There were so many fantastic characters that were involved in this escape from, you know, countries all over Western and Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, I tell my books, the stories of my books, I tell through the people that actually made the history. And I look for really interesting, colorful characters. And I also look for people who've never really gotten credit for what they've done. And with Last Hope Island, there were just many, many, many to choose from.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk to some of them in just a moment, but for the longest time, I thought you were English.
No.
So
I know. It is somewhat strange that an American has fixed on this topic as kind of her subject of interest. But I was just fascinated in the beginning of my career as an author by England, and particularly in the early days of World War II, when England was still standing alone,
mm-hmm,
against Hitler, when, you know, the Germans had really conquered virtually all of Western Europe with the exception of this one tiny little island, and that they managed to hold out for as long as they did. And it was such an extraordinary story, and I kept finding aspects of it that I didn't think anybody else had covered, and I still find it fascinating.
Yeah, no, it's marvelous to read. Who referred to Last Hope Island first?
What do you mean? Where it came from?
Yeah, like who, was it Churchill who referred to it first?
No, Last Hope Island actually, Britain was called Last Hope Island by Polish pilots, who came from when Poland was conquered by the Germans in 1939. Many of their armed forces, much of their armed forces left. They escaped to fight on in France, and among them were a whole bunch of pilots who were very, very good, who flew in France, and then when France fell, they went to England to continue the fight, and they referred to England as Last Hope Island because it really was the last hope for freedom in Europe. And if England had fallen, then, you know, Europe would have been totally enslaved by Nazism.
And then there were code breakers, too, that had come from Poland, one in
yes.
particular,
oh, yeah.
Right?
I mean, the whole point of this book is to show that the victory in World War II was not simply the victory of Britain, the U.S., and the Soviet Union, that there were many other countries involved, including, prominently including, these countries of occupied Europe, that, yes, they were defeated, but their governments did flee to Britain and continued the fight. And the Poles were one of the biggest contributors, and not only the pilots that I referred to, the Polish pilots really helped win the Battle of Britain, but also the Poles were the ones who first broke the Germans' Enigma code. It wasn't the British, as most people believe now.
Yeah.
The Poles did it in the early 1930s and turned over all their information to the British just before they were invaded.
So who's to blame then for these Europeans and their role in victory? I mean, and how it's been downplayed. I mean, Churchill has a part.
Churchill has a huge responsibility for that. I mean, you know, it's really ironic because if it hadn't been for Churchill, they would never have been invited to come to Britain.
Mm.
Britain has, and obviously still does, has a reputation of not particularly being fond of foreigners. Britain is an island, and the British are a very insular people, and they feel uncomfortable with alliances. And it was Winston Churchill who made the decision when Britain was standing alone to invite these governments from these occupied countries to come in, along with their armed forces, because they really needed the help. The British needed the help. They needed allies at that point. And the U.S. was not in the war, was still neutral. So he brought them in, and yet after the war, during and after the war, he kept saying that Britain stood alone against Germany, and that was his mantra, really, throughout the war, and as I said, after the war, that Britain stood alone until the U.S. and the Soviet Union got in 1941. So Churchill's view of history and of World War II has been, you know, a very, very powerful one, and that's one of the main reasons, I think, that these countries did not get the credit for what they did.
Yeah, and so how did they react to that? I mean, throughout the book, they still have great fondness towards the English and the English people. But, I mean, having their achievements or accomplishments downplayed like that, I mean, did that stick in their craw at all?
Yes, I think it did. But at the same time, there was a tremendous gratitude to Britain and to Churchill for providing them with a place of refuge during the war. If it hadn't been for Britain, you know, that they wouldn't have been able to do what they did. They would have been defeated. I mean, they wouldn't have had any role in the victory. They couldn't have fought on. And Britain also, I should point out, Britain also provided a sense of hope for those countries. I mean, the occupation policy of the Germans was terrible. It was. I mean, they were enslaved. It was really horrendous. And so there was a sense of hopelessness, a sense of total despair. And to know that Britain was actually standing up against Hitler, as I said, gave them a sense of hope for continuing the fight.
And so they felt welcomed. I mean, we tend to...
They felt welcomed. I'm not, I don't want to give the impression that everything was sweetness and light.
Right.
It wasn't.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a lot of conflict that went on. There were clashes in terms of what the British thought was best and what these countries thought was best. I mean, especially after the U.S. got into the war, there was a lot of the Europeans often thought that the British didn't really understand what it was like to be occupied. You know, that they had a mindset. I mean, that they truly didn't understand what it was like. And the British thought the Europeans were being too difficult, and there were a lot of conflicts, there were a lot of fights. But the thing that's important that they all realized was that they had to band together to help defeat Hitler, and they did. It was a contentious partnership, but it was a partnership. They really joined together in this fight, and. I'm not saying that the Europeans were responsible for the victory. I mean, that was clearly the bulk of, the troops, et cetera, mm-hmm. came from the U.S. and the Soviets. But they were responsible for for example, helping win the Battle of Britain and helping win the Battle of the Atlantic, and they provided a lot of intelligence for D-Day. So they really played a major role that has not really been given the credit that it's due.
Well, we live in such anxious times, and especially today, the relationship between Britain and the rest of Europe is mired in Brexit and the sort. I mean, there are some contemporary lessons here in your book about just how these people can come together in times of great difficulty and with great courage, with grit, and a lot of strength.
Absolutely. It's so sad that what they were able to accomplish together has been somewhat forgotten, or you know, by a lot of people. You know, that experience that the European leaders had in England helped lead to the creation of the European Union. I mean, it was with Britain inviting them in the way it did, they were able to actually get to know each other and to actually work together. That would never have happened if it hadn't been for World War II. And in getting to know each other and working together, they realized that if they wanted to avoid this kind of catastrophe from happening again, they really needed to band together. They really needed to come together and work together as a united Europe. And they began doing that during the war. And really, Britain was the seedbed for the creation of the European Union. And, you know, regardless of the way one looks at the European Union now, mm-hmm. there's no question that it was responsible for decades of an extraordinary peace and prosperity in Western Europe.
The other thing that you do in this book is talk about the BBC and its importance throughout all of this. There's a great affection for it from you know, all these folks that you write about in the book. You write actually that it bordered on idolatry at one point.
Yeah, I mean, when I was referring before to the sense of hope and inspiration that the British gave occupied Europe, the people in occupied Europe, I'm really talking specifically about the BBC. Mm. The BBC before the war was, you know, was an insular news organization. I mean, they really only broadcast to Britain and to the Commonwealth. But when the war began, they started what they called the European Service, and they had broadcast to virtually every country in Europe, including the occupied countries. Now, it was against the law. I mean, the Germans outlawed the possession of a radio set in all these countries because they feared what would happen. And in some countries, that if you broke that law, you were punished by death. But the Europeans didn't care. I mean, millions of Europeans kept their radios and hid them, and then would take them out every night to listen to the BBC. And what the BBC was broadcasting was basically news. I mean, they were broadcasting the truth about what was really going on, and they were letting the Europeans know that they weren't alone. That Britain was holding out. And then they broadcast when the U.S. got into the war. And so that there was a sense of great hope and inspiration thanks to the BBC. And that continued throughout the war. Mm. And after the war, as you said, the BBC was flooded with messages and letters and from people who said, you know, you saved our lives. I mean, you know, we couldn't have made it through the war without you.
You know, one of the things I've been wondering about as I'm reading your book is had Churchill not lost in 1945, how different would the relationship between Britain and the rest of Europe have been, especially the relationship between, say Europe and the Soviet Union?
You know, that's really hard to answer. Even if he had won in 1945, he still believed, when we're talking about Europe, he still believed that England, Britain should cooperate with a united Europe, but should not be part of it. He always thought that Britain's future lay with the United States and with the Empire, which still was an empire then, and the Commonwealth. And so he, even though he encouraged European countries to band together. He said that Britain would not be part of that union. So, as I said, even if he had won in 1945, I don't know that anything would have been different. He certainly was trying very hard in terms of the Soviet Union to work, you know, on a possible coming together, you know, working to kind of not stop the Cold War, but to alleviate the Cold War.
Mm.
But by that time, you know, Britain did not have the, you know, the power or the influence that it once had. I mean, it had lost so much of that. So even, again, if he had been elected, he probably would not have had much of an impact.
So many fascinating characters. I mean, I haven't touched on the monarchs from the various countries that had come to England at the
mm-hmm.
time. We know of de Gaulle and his relationship with the British after the war. During the war, when he gets to Britain, whatever he experienced there, did that shape ultimately the relationship that he felt towards England?
Oh, yeah. No, yes. It not only shaped how he felt toward England, but it shaped how he felt toward the United States. And it really affected the relationship between France and the United States and between France and England, and to the detriment of both the U.S. and Britain. He always felt that he was not treated well, to put it mildly. By Churchill and especially by Roosevelt. Roosevelt made it very clear that he couldn't stand him, you know, right from the beginning. I mean, Roosevelt had never met him, really didn't know that much about what was going on. But he felt that France had failed, you know, the world by capitulating in 1940, and he never really forgave the country for that. And he always thought of de Gaulle as kind of this upstart who, you know, had no business, you know, trying to, you know, announcing that he was head of free France. And Roosevelt didn't want anything to do with that. And he ridiculed him. He made life difficult for him. He refused to allow either de Gaulle or his forces to be involved in any sort of offensive, you know, whether it was in North Africa or at D-Day. And obviously, de Gaulle was a difficult, haughty, arrogant man, and he took all of this very, very badly. Churchill was trying to be kind of the intermediary between them.
Yeah.
But basically, he followed, you know, in Roosevelt's footsteps, and whatever Roosevelt wanted, Churchill, whether he wanted to do it or not, usually followed, and that was true with de Gaulle. And so de Gaulle never forgot and never forgave either Churchill or Roosevelt for the treatment that they gave him.
Yeah. As you write these marvelous books that you write, how much travel do you do in terms of the research?
With this one, I had done a lot of travel before. This book had a kind of an odd history. I started working on it 8 or 9 years ago, and then realized that I did a lot of travel at that point, and realized that I felt it was too big a book for me to finish at that point. So I went back to it after I finished my previous book, and I decided this would be the next one. And so I did a lot more research, but most of the travel I had already done. And, you know, since I focus on this period and particularly on Britain, England, I had built up a lot of knowledge about these people
mm-hmm.
That I was writing about in this book. Even though I had not mentioned them in other books, I felt I wasn't coming to this, you know, as a newcomer. I knew a lot about the period, particularly. I mean, the book covers all of World War II, but it really focuses its you know, on 1940, when these countries were defeated, and then, you know, how all these leaders, these kings and queens and prime ministers and, you know, soldiers and sailors come to Britain. So it's something that I have, worked on for quite some time. So it all came together really in this book.
Now, I'm not the only one who when they read your books, I mean, I think of the Lindbergh book and Troublesome Young Men and Citizens of London, who sit there and like Lost Hope Island, just sit there just enthralled and enjoying the process. What's it like then to write a book like
well,
that?
Thank you very much. When my husband and I've written two books with my husband, and when we started writing books, we're both former journalists, but we wanted to write, and these clearly are nonfiction, but we wanted to write books as though they were fiction. In other words, to try to make them as interesting as possible and to tell them through the viewpoint, the eyes of the major characters who were involved. That's always been my motto. I mean, it's to find out as much as you can about the people who are, who are actually at the center of these events, and to tell the story through them. Because, people are the ones who make history. History is not just created in a vacuum. It's human beings who do it. And so that has really been my way of writing ever since the beginning. And so that's really what I've been trying to do, make it a story, that people will want to read. I want readers to become involved in these people's lives, as they are making history. I want them to understand them if they can, to live with them. I want to bring them to life, and I want to put people in the moment, what it was like to be, for example, in the case of the King of Norway, to be chased through the mountains of Norway in the snow and the ice by German troops who were trying to kill him. So I want people to, to feel like they're there. And I think if they do, then history will come alive and it will mean more.
Yeah, that's a riveting part of the book where you talk about the king and having to literally run for his life. He's in a building or a palace of some sort, and then minutes later into the forest with all of his men.
Absolutely, while German planes are dive bombing them and strafing them, and Hitler ordered them to kill this king, and luckily he made it out alive. But it's a great story.
There's some other marvelous people. John Hackett, for example. I know that you have great affection for him.
Yes.
Audrey Hepburn and Madeleine
Audrey
Albright.
Audrey Hepburn's in it. Yeah.
Yeah. About Hackett for just a moment. Why is his story important?
John Hackett, it's important on a number of levels. John Hackett was a young brigadier general. He was in charge of a parachute brigade that was sent into Arnhem. He was part of the Operation Market Garden, which was an attempt late in the war to break into Germany. It was a stupid idea from the beginning. It had almost no chance of working. It was a British operation. It was the brainchild of General Montgomery, Bernard Montgomery, and it was a total failure. Thousands of parachutists were sent to the Dutch town of Arnhem, which lay across the Rhine River from Germany, and the Germans were waiting for them. And it was a joint British-American operation, but the parachutists themselves were British, and they were pretty much wiped out. There were a couple of hundred survivors, including John Hackett, who was badly, badly wounded, and was put into a hospital, almost died, and then was spirited out of the hospital along with many of his colleagues by members of the Dutch resistance and hidden in homes near Arnhem. Hackett spent 4 months in a house in a little tiny town near Arnhem, recovering from his wounds. The house was owned by three unmarried sisters who had never done any kind of resistance work before. Mm-hmm. And they hid. This town was filled with Germans. I mean, German soldiers were everywhere, including right next door. And they hid this young hotshot general until he had fully recovered. And in those 4 months, Hackett basically was relying on them for his life. And he wrote a wonderful book after the war called I Was a Stranger, in which he talked about how he became member of this family,
yeah.
and that their love and their courage in hiding him, and it changed his life. It really changed his life. He became a member of the Dutch Resistance, while he was there. It's an extraordinary story because he was one of the very, very few Brits or allies who actually spent time yeah. in occupied Europe. I mean, who spent time as a fugitive, and he saw the privations and the difficulties of this family, the hunger, the lack of heat, the oppression of the Germans. And again, he witnessed their courage in hiding him, because they would have been killed if they had been discovered.
Yeah.
And he just, as I said, it totally changed his life, and he stayed very close to that family for the rest of his life. And when about 50 years after the Battle of Arnhem, he and various others who had been rescued by the resistance donated a plaque in at the cemetery in Arnhem, and it's one of the most touching inscriptions I have ever read. I mean, I have told people that when I wrote the story of John Hackett and this family, I cry, and every time I read about it, I cry, because it's not so much because of my talent as a writer; it's because of Hackett's talent yeah. as a writer, and his amazing descriptions of what it was like to be taken in by strangers and kept safe for all this time. Yeah. Why would they do it? I mean, the Brits had come in and had made their life even worse because Arnhem failed.
Yeah.
But they didn't care. I mean, they were very, very brave, and they kept, at least more than 100 British paratroopers alive, and they got them out eventually.
I mean, that's your gift. I mean, just the humanity just comes through your writing. I mean, of these people, it's just beautiful.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that, and that's to me the ultimate compliment, because I really, that's what I'm trying to get across, is the humanity of all this. You know, that these weren't just events. They had effects on real people, and I wanted readers to know that.
No, it's cruel of me to ask you this, Lynn, as you commence this book tour, but as a fan, what might you be working on next?
Well, usually at this point in, when I've just finished the book, I say, and it's truthful, I don't know. In this case, I do know, because I just signed a contract for a new book with Random House, who's been my publisher for 3 books.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a book on somebody that's actually in this book. It's a book on the French Resistance and a woman who led one of the leading Allied spy networks in France. She's a young, very attractive mother of 2 young children, and she was the leader of a very important spy network from the beginning of the war until the end.
That's Rousseau, right?
No. Jeannie Rousseau was in this woman's network. Her name is Marie Madeleine Fourcade.
Ah, there you go.
And she is in Last Hope Island. But one of the reasons I'm writing this book about her is because I write big kind of books that are dealing with a lot of people, and I get frustrated sometimes because they're so interesting, and I can only spend, 1 or 2 pages sometimes on them. And I thought, this woman is too interesting and too important not to be able to write a whole book about her. And that's what I'm doing.
Well, until then, we'll urge people to read this book. It's such a pleasure to talk to you today. As you know, a great fan, and this is such a beautiful book. Congratulations, and good luck with it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
The book is called Last Hope Island, Britain Occupied Europe and the Brotherhood That Helped Turn the Tide of War. It's published by Random House. In early April, Lynn Olson joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.